Greetings, everyone. It is now time for Marked Safe. Tales of your very favorite and most beloved disasters. On Marked Safe, we discuss events and details that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Please listen responsibly and stay safe. And now, here with your hosts, Brianne and Melanie, this is Marked Safe.
Hey, bestie.
Hey.
How are you today?
Fine. We didn't talk about how to open this up at all.
No, we didn't.
I was like, let's jump in. Jump. Cannonball. How's it going, man?
It's going. Still vertical.
Yeah. Well, you know what they say, that when you ask white people that and they say something like that, it means they might, who knows, punch a hole in a wall. There's a meme about that, about if you ask a white person and they say, like, how's it going? And they say, it's going. That's a cry for help.
Oh. Well, I didn't say it's going. I said
no,
still vertical.
No, but there's a lot of different. No, you said still vertical. It's going. Living the dream. All the same genre. Are you
okay? Hashtag blessed.
Hashtag blessed. Are you okay?
Yes, I'm okay.
Okay. I want to jump into brackets, honestly, because I was so sad that we missed it. And then we missed a week, so we missed even more brackets. And I have so much Buckeye bullshit to tell you about today.
Listen, we didn't even come up with the new bracket, so we've got to post that this.
Oh yeah,
straight yeah. away. Are we going to do away. Sandwiches?
You sound like a British school marm. I love it. Straight away,
straight away. Sandwiches? You want to do sandwiches, or you got something else in mind?
I don't know. Maybe should we get it down to a couple and let the people vote?
Yeah,
because that already kind of happened, and I wasn't paying attention. That's possible. That happens sometimes.
I know people were screaming about sandwiches and not to put hot dogs on the bracket. I mean, I will if we are doing sandwiches, because no one could tell me what to do.
I might be your top, but they're not.
Might even throw a taco in there just to be an asshole.
Look, is this sponsored by Sandwich Daddy? The mind behind spaghetti tacos? Is this brought to you? Is this a partnership with Sandwich Daddy that we're doing here?
It should be, shouldn't it?
That would be unhinged.
All right, we'll figure it out.
All right, maybe how many decisions do I get to make today with this?
Well, you can be the top and make all the decisions and make my job easier.
I know, but like, how many decisions are there? Like, how many bracket answers do I have to give you today?
Two.
Okay,
let's wrap
it
up.
This
wrap
is the
it
end?
Up like okay. a sandwich. Wrap.
Absolutely. Lay it on me.
All right. So I did go back, and the one I couldn't figure out was if you pick lumberjack or taxes. And you actually.
I'm in suspense too. What did I pick?
You picked lumberjacks.
Yeah, I think I kind of saw taxes going all the way, and I didn't really want that.
You pruned it like the lumberjack you are. So
yeah, I had to. You know what I'm not pruning, by the way, just as the most irrelevant aside of all time? We got a hydroponic garden for the kitchen counter, and I don't think it was meant to have a cucumber plant in it.
Mm.
I think it was meant maybe to be more of an herb garden, possibly something chill, like a little tomato plant, but someone who may or may not be my life partner, despite this decision, somebody put cucumber seeds in there, and now there are cucumber, you know, the little tendrils grabbing stuff all around. It's completely out of hand. It is like the cucumber plant that took over New York. It is balls out. It's balls out. It's crazy. I don't know what's
you
gonna
happen.
You can
make pickles.
It hasn't even gotten to the point of making cucumbers yet. It is unwieldy. I'm scared of it, but I'm also rooting for it. Anyway, speaking of the pruning, I don't think we were supposed to make the decisions we did with this cucumber plant, and I think that it's going to get me on an episode by the time it's all said and done, because this thing is out of control. Back to the pruning I actually did.
All right, so to get to the final two, Lumberjacks versus Wigglers.
Oh, dude, come on, Wigglers.
Wigglers.
Wigglers. I mean, honestly, like, Lumberjacks aren't really even my genre of, you know, anything. I keep talking about Thirst Trap Lumberjacks, which really tells you what side of TikTok I'm on. Because, you know, they also do serve a vital purpose in our economy. But no, man, I love a water wiggler. And I just got one for Adelaide for Valentine's Day, and it's the best one I've ever gotten. What? I sent you a video of it.
I know. It was like sucking stuff into the void.
It's ridiculous. It needs to chill, frankly. But also, it has reminded me that water wigglers have held up. So, all right. Throw the next one at me.
Well, hold on. You know what I got for the bracket basket for this?
What did you get?
Speaking of thirst trap TikTokers, that Thorin Bradley, he makes his own candles. Or oh, he has his own candle and room spray line.
Oh, I love your basket so much.
Apparently, you're supposed to smell like him.
Wow. Well, I don't think I would be as moved by his smell as many people would, but I'm sure it does smell pleasant.
Yeah, I can't wait for it to come in. Might have to order one for myself.
You can sniff it first, see if you want to.
All right, so Wigglers versus Sandwiches.
This is the final two that it's come down to?
Yep.
Man. Wigglers, that's hard, Melanie. That's really hard because, I mean, Wigglers, to be honest, they are a one-trick pony.
I know. You can't make a bracket out of them.
It's a good trick, though. And would it be right to potentially pick Sandwiches and then go straight into a sandwich bracket?
It's kind of sexy.
I don't know. It feels a little nepotism somehow.
A little nepo bracket?
A little nepotism somehow. I don't know. You know what? My mind says Sandwiches, but my heart says Wigglers.
You fucking pick Wigglers. Wow, what a curveball.
Who said I was going to follow my heart? I'm an Aquarius.
Wigglers.
Just because that's my heart doesn't mean it's going to win, but it is because I have to be true to myself.
Never in a million years when we started this bracket really? Would I have ever picked a Wiggler.
See, I would have. If I had looked at it from the beginning, I would have been like, yeah, I know my bullshit that could win.
You do like fidgety stuff.
I love fidgety stuff. I have a basket that is shamefully big, full of slime and fidgets and all of this stuff. Ostensibly, it's Adelaide's. Her and I both know we have shared custody of it. Wigglers are always a prized addition to it. And Sandwiches, I mean, they might be getting their moment to shine real soon, you know?
Maybe. We'll see.
Maybe. Maybe they don't want to shine anymore after that. I don't know.
Well,
I mean, also, there's so much stuff you could put in a Wiggler. There's so... oh, my God. I don't mean like that. I mean, like, glitter. Oh, no. I didn't even mean it like that.
Mm-hmm.
You could put dye in there. You could put glitter. You could put mix-ins.
Mix-ins?
Mix-ins.
Kind of mix-ins.
You tell me. I don't know, but I am going to follow my heart. It's Wigglers.
All right.
Well, and I'll tell you right now, they're $2 at Target in case you need to throw one in the bracket box.
Well, it's a must. It has to happen.
Well, it does now, yeah.
Yeah. And you can do all sorts of things with it. Whoever wins this, we'll sort it out.
You can put a lot of things in there.
Whatever your heart desires.
Mm-hmm. Or any other part of you.
You can
put your heart in there. Who knows?
You can spray it with a lumberjack spray.
Okay. What kind of kit are you sending people in the mail, Melanie?
It's nonsense.
Is it, though?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, should we get into it?
Let's get into it. Do I get a part two today?
You do get a part two. I got the giggles before we've even started this. And thank God, because I'm here to tell you that this week I decided to do three Ohio stories, and the first one was neat and tidy and concise and not too upsetting. Not too upsetting at all, really. And then the second one was quite a bit longer and quite a bit darker. And then the third one was even longer than that and darker than the first two combined.
Oh, it's like a roller coaster.
It is. So trust me when I say that I am easing you into this.
All right.
So after the last episode, everybody wanted to know one thing, which was, when were we going to talk about the Cuyahoga River's bullshit? We touched on that cursed river in the first compilation, but there's so much more to know, and you guys really wanted to know it because it kept coming up.
Goat Granny has asked for this, by the way.
Oh, well.
Because she's from them parts.
I'm happy to oblige Goat Granny. For a body of water, this thing could not stop catching fire for a while. Maybe because it was less a body of water and more a body of toxic flammable pollution.
Stop talking about me like that.
That's your top. I'm allowed. Buckeye Tim Donovan told Smithsonian Magazine, "The river was a scary little thing. There was a general rule that if you fell in, God forbid, you would go immediately to the hospital." Same article described the river even more vividly. "The water was nearly always covered in oil slicks, and it bubbled like a deadly stew. Sometimes rats floated by, their corpses so bloated that they were practically the size of dogs." This is the whimsical one, don't forget.
Have you ever seen... Okay. A long time ago, I was in a roommate situation. There was kind of like a rat problem outside. It was I don't know. We were in Southern California. We got some torrential rains.
Ooh.
The rats got it in the garbage can that was empty. The garbage can did not have any drainage. Oh. There was like 4 severely bloated rats. So when you said that, like, I know that visual.
Yeah, my mom has a story that is similar about a bloated possum in a bucket when I was a child, and she's still petrified of possums to this day. So, much like people who measure their worth by their productivity, and their productivity by their busyness, and their busyness by their exhaustion, and thus they wear their exhaustion as a badge of honor, the state of the river was seen as proof of the area's economic success, since pollution was coming mainly from nearby manufacturing plants. So lots of pollution meant thriving manufacturing plants, meant jobs. Full of chemicals and oil slicks as it wasn't huge news when it caught fire in 1868. When it happened again in 1883, I mean, it's not like this kind of event was unprecedented by now. I'm sure somebody was making old-timey memes about it by the time it happened in 1887, but I bet they were starting to lose their senses of humor about it by the times it happened in 1912, 1922, 1936, 1941, 1948, and 1952. It was a local tradition at this point. In the broader national discussion, to put it simply, nobody gave a fuck. Until 1969, when it happened again. This one caused a quick $50,000 in damage, which was about $419,000 in today's money, but it was put out in under an hour with no pictures of it even taken. It would have been just a footnote in Ohio history, but months after the fact, Time magazine slapped a photo of the river on fire in 1952 on an article about the Cuyahoga River fires. Nat Geo followed with a feature on the state of the river the following year, and public attention and the political mood at the moment combined to make the river sort of a poster child for industrial pollution. A pair of historians wrote, "The fire took on mythic status, and errors of fact became unimportant to the story's obvious meaning. Clearly, this transformative fire must have been massive. The nation must have seen the flames and been appropriately moved. Neither is true." However, media attention did ultimately lead to the development of the Environmental Protection Agency. And in the wake of the new focus on environmental health, the Cuyahoga River hasn't burned in a long time at this point, but, quote, "other scientists have cautioned that the river is still burning with viruses, bacteria, and parasites, including Salmonella, Clostridium, enteroviruses, Giardia, and Hepatitis A."
Oof.
Yeah. So that's your warm-up story, because people really wanted to finish the story on the Cuyahoga River. None of it has a whole lot of story to it. It just would not stop catching fire for a long time. It just would not stop. In 1979, The Who was touring. Something I did not know before researching this episode was that as a band, they were a mess. Did you know this?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So they had a widespread reputation for constant drama and disagreement within their group. And their drummer, Keith Moon, had a personality that made Varuk's Inception sound like tea and crumpets in the park. I said I owed you a chaotic man last week, and I am a woman of my word. I bring you Keith Moon, drummer for The Who. Keith's antics weren't directly related to the incident that I'm going to tell you about, but I included them just for you. Keith liked to destroy furniture and property, and he committed to the bit far beyond when a person should. He picked up an amphetamine habit, and his reputation for destroying his instruments and hotel rooms preceded him. Quote, Moon began destroying hotel rooms when The Who stayed at the Berlin Hotel on tour in late 1966. In addition to hotel rooms, Moon destroyed his friends' homes, and even his own, including throwing furniture from upper-story windows. Andrew Neil and Michael Ken estimated that his destruction of hotel toilets and plumbing cost as much as $500,000.
Jeez.
These acts, often fueled by drugs and alcohol, were Moon's way of demonstrating his eccentricity, and he enjoyed shocking the public with them. Longtime friend and personal assistant Dougal Butler observed,
he was trying to be funny.
He wanted people to love and enjoy him, but he would go so far, like a train ride you couldn't stop. In a limousine on the way to the airport, Moon insisted they return to their hotel, saying, I forgot something. At the hotel, he ran back to his room, grabbed the television, threw out the window into the swimming pool below. He then jumped back into the limo, saying, I nearly forgot. End quote.
Oh my gosh.
Fucking menace. He would first flush cherry bombs and then later actual dynamite down hotel toilets. Fully exploding toilets. Like, this was not like a little detonation later because it was in the water or something. Like, this was throwing toilets across rooms. He started passing out drunk on stage. First time he was carried off stage, given a cortisone shot, and returned to finish the show. Another time he didn't come back and a drummer in the audience took his place on stage.
Could you imagine
that guy? No one would believe you.
No one.
In another incident, quote, Moon started a food fight and soon cake began flying through the air. The drummer knocked out part of his front tooth. At the hospital, the doctors could not give him an anesthetic due to his inebriation before removing the remainder of the tooth. Back at the hotel, a melee erupted. Fire extinguishers were set off, guests and objects thrown into the swimming pool, and a piano reportedly destroyed. The chaos ended only when police arrived with guns drawn. A furious Holiday Inn management presented the groups with a bill for $24,000, which was reportedly settled by Herman's Hermits tour manager, Ed McMahon. Townshend claims that The Who were banned from life for all of the hotel's properties, but Fletcher wrote that they stayed at a Holiday Inn in Rochester, New York, a week later. He also disputed a widely held belief that Moon drove a Lincoln Continental into the hotel swimming pool, as claimed by the drummer in a 1972 Rolling Stones interview. End quote. So, I started doing this one. I just thought, let me just check really fast, see if there's anything relevant as far as like the band's culture, where they were at that moment in time that I really need to elaborate on to set the scene. And the rabbit hole was just so unhinged. And I do think that it's kind of relevant to the story because of the moment that the band was in at this time. Keith Moon died trying to get sober on clomethiazole without medical supervision. And 15 months later, this was the band's first tour without him. So you would think that, I mean, sad as that is, they had to be expecting a lower level of chaos than normal.
Right.
But that's not exactly what they got. So on a cold Monday night in December, Cincinnati's Riverfront Coliseum was sold out. Do you know the story? I'm sure you know the story.
I don't think so.
Oh my gosh, it's got Melanie all over it. Venue had a capacity of 17,000. 18,348 tickets had been sold. There had been a miscommunication with a local radio station saying that general admission seating would be done earlier than it was. So by the time things were actually starting to happen, the crowd was bigger than it would have been expected to be. Radio said 3, it turned out to be 7. It was freezing outside where people were lined up. It was December. People wanted to go in. They were drinking. They were high. They were super hyped for the show. So they were pissed when they heard it starting while they were still outside the gates, which, understandable, who wouldn't be? People started throwing things. People threw a bottle through a window, and some others tried to squeeze through it. And when the doors did start opening, instead of all of them, it was just one or two. And anybody who's listened for more than a few episodes will probably know what follows when that happens. An usher named Ray said, "Three or four of us tried to hold them back, but it was no use. We couldn't hold them back. They carried in one boy and laid him on a table and he died. Others were laying out in the plaza. I'd never seen anything like it. I can't even tell you what killed them." Oh, a 15-year-old named Suzanne said, "You could see people getting hurt. People were flailing elbows and smashing noses. You could see people going down." An army veteran who was attending worked his way through a pile of people on the ground to get to a woman who was holding onto his leg at the bottom of the pile, but she was dead before he could reach her. A horrible detail is that the show wasn't even starting. The people mistook either a mic check or a trailer for the band's movie being played over the speakers.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, not that it would have been better if the band had been playing.
Right.
It's just, 11 people died of asphyxiation. 15-year-old Karen, 15-year-old Jacqueline, 17-year-old Brian, 18-year-old Peter, 19-year-old David, 19-year-old Stephen, 20-year-old Philip, 21-year-old Connie, 21-year-old James, 22-year-old Walter, and 27-year-old Tiva.
Oh, they're all so young.
I know. Eight others were seriously injured, and like always, let me just pause on the serious injury caveat. It's always hard to find solid information on those, but a lot of times these are catastrophic injuries that may affect somebody for the rest of their lives, or which may have been fatal with any change or delay in medical care. We brush that off like it's a scraped knee, but no. I mean, we try not to, but the media does.
Right.
I think our minds do. Something like 25 people were injured, but eight of them were serious, and I just always want to pause on that. In too many of the cases, even timely medical care wasn't enough. One paramedic said, "We have all sorts of life-saving devices. We have drugs, we have highly trained people, and none of it did a bit of good. They just died. We couldn't save a one of them." The concert was not canceled.
What?
Yeah. Even though this happened at the beginning / before it had even started.
What year is this again?
79.
Oh.
Fire department had tried to talk the band manager into canceling, but he refused. The mayor later said that it was because they thought there would be a riot if they did. When the bodies were removed, the band took to the stage with no idea what had happened.
Oh, they didn't even let them know.
That's like worse than what you did to me with the lightning strike episode. Only a little.
Only a little?
They were told after the show. And most concertgoers found out what had happened when they arrived home to their terrified families, watching the news and waiting to see if their loved ones were killed. The guitarist said much later, "I went through two phases. One was, of course, tremendous upset and concern, but the other was incredible anger that we'd been performing while this was going on." At the end of their set, their manager told them that they had a big problem and needed to do a quick two-song encore, and they did so without knowing why. And most of the disappointed fans didn't know why they got such a short encore either. The Rolling Stone article said about the manager, Bill Kerbishley, "After the 1979 show finally got underway," Kerbishley recalls, "he caught a glimpse of the night's carnage. The band didn't see it. I saw it when I went up in the plaza level with the medics, so I saw just how catastrophic it was," Kerbishley says. "There were so many people there unconscious and on the floor and injured. I knew straight away that there'd be people dead. It was almost like a bomb had exploded." Kerbishley had never seen destruction on that scale. "I was 37 at the time," he says. "First thing I saw was this medic pumping this young girl, trying to get her back to consciousness, and I thought, fuck, what has happened here? To see these young people and the desperation that was running through the whole place, it was a bad sight. It's a thing that will always be with me." End quote.
The fact that no one told.
It's so messed up. And you know they had to be just tone deaf as hell, and you know they probably felt like shit about it later. One survivor named Jerry told the Rolling Stone years later, "You don't expect to fight for your life at a Who concert. It was kind of like hell. There was nothing we could do to get out of it." Now, Jerry himself had quite a story. He said, "All of a sudden, 10 or 15 of us fell to the ground, and people were falling on top of us. It was just ridiculous. Everyone was trying to force the crowd back and help everyone up. 10 minutes later, it happened again. They hadn't opened the doors yet, and we kept getting compressed. It wasn't even dark yet, but soon there wasn't any room to fall." When the crushing began, he had lost most of his group, but he spotted Lisa, his friend's sister, in the crowd. It was Lisa's 16th birthday. She was struggling. Jerry told Lisa to stay with him. From the Rolling Stone article, quote, "He started off by looping his arms around Lisa, holding strangers back just so she could breathe. Still, the two of them continued getting knocked to the ground together, and as much as he tried to keep the crowd at literal arm's length, Lisa kept desperately telling Jerry, 'I can't breathe.' At that moment, Jerry did the only thing he could do. He raised Lisa above the crush and rested her on his shoulders until she would say, 'It's okay, I can breathe.' Lisa said many years later, 'Everybody just started pushing and pushing, and we got pushed back. I'm only 4'9", and I was about 100 pounds, and I could just not breathe. And he would lift me up, and we would get another wave, and it was just, I was so close to him, he had facial hair, and it burned my cheek." She credits Jerry with saving her life at the concert. In the aftermath, most people, from survivors to experts, attributed the tragedy to the festival seating. Some of the seats were assigned, but some were first come, first serve, and that seemed to, a lot of people really put it down to that. There was just an excessive sense of urgency to get inside. So there was a lot of, I think, understandable anti-festival seating sentiment after that. There was also a predictable wave of reactionary responses. The mayor of Rhode Island canceled a scheduled Who concert, even though it was assigned seating. The band returned to the city in 2012, and they honored tickets from that canceled show from the 70s.
Oh, that's neat.
Right? The Who did not tour in Cincinnati again for 43 years, until 2022, when their opening act was a local band called Safe Passage, made up of students from the Finneytown High School class of 1979, with the names and pictures of the victims displayed on screen throughout the show. And proceeds from the show funded 11 memorial scholarships.
I love it and I hate it.
Yeah, so that was your medium awful story. Are you ready for the hot sauce terrible one? Check your content warnings.
There people. We go.
Here we this.
Grab your this, wigglers.
Grab your wigglers whenever you need to console yourself. this one is just so fucking grim. And here we go. Okay, so since I bait and switched you on a chaotic man last week, I offer you not one, but two chaotic yet tragic men this week to make up for it. This time we have Terry, for once an Aquarius. I'm not surprised that Aquarians are rarely bad people who end up on our podcast for obvious reasons, but I do frankly feel that we are underrepresented among the unhinged but complex people. I'll let you decide where to fall on Terry, but yes, unlike you, I will do you the courtesy of giving you a lightning strike warning on this one.
Okay.
If you know, you know. Terry William Johnson was born in Zanesville, Ohio in 1949 and grew up on a 73-acre farm with his two sisters, which he inherited when his parents died. Also, I just want to say, I really try not to pull too heavily from any one source, but I did pull quite heavily, very heavily from this one, because this GQ article was one of the longest form articles I've ever read for the show, and it was some of the best journalism I've ever read, and it just, you can't find most of the facts anywhere else.
Right.
So I'm kind of deferring to the GQ article on most of this, but I'm obviously leaving out a shit ton, so I highly recommend reading it. So, like I said, grew up on the 73-acre farm with his two sisters. He inherits it when his parents die. He would ride his bike to watch the planes taking off and landing at a nearby airport. He was obsessed with flying. And he had a good life. He had striking blue eyes, very striking. He was known to be a ladies' man, which had to have been easy when he had his pilot's license at 15. I mean,
yeah.
Right? He was drafted into the Vietnam War with the army, and he was not happy about it. He enjoyed the life that he was living, and he really was not interested in this. Mm-hmm. But he ended up flying helicopters and seeing some really unspeakable things. While he was there in a tent, he was befriended by a monkey, and they apparently looked out for each other for the rest of his tour. And it seems like he really attributed that monkey to the fact that he made it out at all, as far as his sanity goes. He saw things so awful that were detailed more in the GQ article, but I've decided not to include them here. And he never recovered from the experience, as so many people understandably don't. He struggled really hard with survivor's guilt about the fact that he had lived for, in his mind, no particular reason, and his friends who had wives and kids at home didn't. He could not reconcile the lives that he'd been forced to take. And I mean, really, being drafted, quite literally forced to take.
Right, right.
He could not reconcile that with his Christian faith. He just couldn't. Neighbor who had known him both before and after he went said he always laughed and would be real pleasant before. He smiled a lot. When he came back, he had a funny look. You know what I mean? He was kind of a loner. He was just a bit different from the other ones. I think he had a little touch of Agent Orange. I said that he never left Vietnam. I'm going to put it that way. He never left it.
Wow.
So Terry married a woman named Marion when he was 20. Terry married Marion. she was a talented horsewoman described as, quote, kind of classy, kind of uppity, carried herself gracefully, a nice girl. Despite their outward appearance as an odd couple, they did relatively well together for years, decades, with Marion teaching and Terry running the local Harley shop. He bred Dobermans, which he did not train. And he continued to fly, collected cars, motorcycles, planes, as well as an old fire truck that he and Marion drove around town at night. He just loved to have the best and the most and the fastest. His quirks got him a very mixed social standing in town. He did actually have a lot of close friends who were very loyal to him and seemed to really get him, and a lot of people who hated him or were scared of him. And his reputation preceded him. One friend told a story about Terry getting pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt. When the officer said he'd have to ticket him, Terry asked how many tickets he had in his book. Officer estimated 75, and Terry said, "You might as well keep riding, because when I leave here, I'm not fastening my seatbelt." So, also, my shameless people, I don't know if this is accurate. I actually don't think I've come across a picture of Terry's face in all this research. But I am fully envisioning Terry Milkovich. If you watch Shameless, if you know, you know. I don't think I'm too wrong personality-wise. So at some point, Terry converted the family farm, you could say. It started in the late 70s with a tiger cub for Marion. And then it expanded. He called it the Muskingum County Animal Farm, and he collected exotic animals now, in addition to the many, many other things he had collected over time. Among other things, Terry had one macaque monkey, one baboon, two wolves, two other unspecified primates, three grizzly bears, three leopards, three mountain lions, six black bears, 17 African lions, and 18 Bengal tigers, as well as an unknown number of cheetahs, giraffes, and camels.
Oh, he really packed him in there.
He did, yeah.
It's only, Terry, you said it was 73 acres?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it, oh, geez.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like butts to nuts in there with all these
it
animals.
It is butts to nuts. I love it when that phrase comes back. Terry had never been quiet about his lifestyle. He exhibited animals at local schools. He lacked the USDA license needed to do that, but he simply did it anyway. In 2005, he was charged with animal cruelty when some cows and a buffalo died of starvation on his property. He was actually convicted and placed on house arrest. In 2008, he served as a handler for Wild Kingdom. He was a handler on the Rachel Ray Show. He was the owner of a lion club used by Heidi Klum in a photo shoot. We allow these sorts of things if they're entertaining. And then when they blow up, we get Tiger King and we're still entertained.
Oh my gosh, so he is not good. Tiger King's going on.
Yeah, there actually is some overlap. Somewhere in one of these, Carol Baskin was involved, but I didn't include that because it was just too much.
Yeah, I guess I was listening to the radio drop-off today, and I guess MGK, like, is blacking out his tattoos. And I guess Tire King was like, what do you say, a little bit of meth and a tire, and I could make him gay or something like that. And was like, God. Basically, like, get me out of here, get me out of jail. How does this man have a phone in jail? I still don't know.
I don't, because the whole stupid world wants to hear what he has to say.
A little bit of meth and a tiger.
A little bit of meth and a tiger. You ain't that straight. So, Terry suffered significantly from depression, as you have probably gathered, and at some point in his life, hoarding behaviors took over as he let his massive collections of valuable items rot and waste away. Neighbors never really knew exactly what all Terry had going on over there, but it is impossible to hide dozens of huge and unusual animals entirely, and he certainly was not trying to. Over the years, they frequently escaped, and many people had called law enforcement many times about the situation, but owning these animals wasn't illegal in Ohio, so he wasn't technically doing much wrong. Ohio had some of the most lax exotics laws in the country and some of the highest rates of injury through those means. The sheriff said about Terry's house, "This is a bad situation. It's been a bad situation for a long time." One of his neighbors, John, said nobody much cared for him. Now, that's not really true. He had groupies, to be honest. But I do think that he had 10 enemies for each groupie, probably. So Terry was actually newly out of prison after being convicted for some gun possession charges and serving a year for that.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. And he was likely to end up on house arrest as a result. He was very in debt. He had gotten out of prison like 3 weeks ago, and the day before things happened, he had recently gotten an anonymous letter the day before in the mail disclosing that his wife had not stayed loyal to him during his prison term.
Who wrote the note?
I don't think anyone knows. So in reality, as Terry's paranoia had increased over the years, he thought that Marion had turned him in for the gun charges, and he had slowly become very abusive toward her. And it seems like they split before he was incarcerated as a result of his behavior. But he had gotten this letter confirming whatever she'd been up to during his sentence the day before these events. And he was already not in a good place. When he was released 3 weeks before this, he didn't call any of his many friends and connections. He walked to Walmart, bought a bike, and rode it 50 miles home in the rain. When he got there, Marion wasn't there. And the place was overgrown as hell. The animals' cages had been moved around, so he no longer knew who was who. He couldn't handle this. He couldn't. He was not in any kind of good place. He told his friend, "She can just have it all. I'm going to die." His friend asked him, are you sick? You have cancer or something? And Terry said, "No, but you'll know when I go." So one Tuesday evening in October of 2011, everything happened. Terry's neighbor, Sam, a retired science teacher, was the first to sound the alarm for the nightmare that was about to unfold. Sam's property, where he lived with his 84-year-old mother, Dolly, shared a property line with Terry. He went out to check on a new horse that he'd bought about a week ago. And only a 4-foot cattle fence surrounded Terry's farm, so that was all that separated it from Sam's farm. When he checked on his horse, I can't word this any better than GQ did. So the long-form GQ article said, quote, "On the other side of the flimsy fence separating them from his neighbor Terry Thompson's property, he noticed that Thompson's horses seemed even more agitated. They were circling, and in the center of their troubled orbit, there was some kind of dark shape. Only when the shape broke out of the circle could he see that it was a black bear," end quote. However, bear wasn't very big, and it was retreating, so Sam took his new horse, and he started toward the barn with him so that he could take his horse to safety and then go call the police. As he did, his eyes caught something that he hadn't seen before. An adult male lion laying in the field with Terry's horses and black bear. Avoiding eye contact or running, he and his horse set out quickly toward the barn, looking back very little. First, they called Terry himself, but they got no answer, so they called the police. Calls immediately started coming into the sheriff's office about animals loose on the interstate. Sam ended up barricaded in the barn. From GQ, quote, "From there, looking through a north-facing window, he watched the menagerie grow. Along came a wolf, and a second bear, this one much larger than the first. And there was the lion he'd seen before, now pacing back and forth. And also a lioness, anxiously scuttering around. And then he says, I saw a tiger. I'm telling you, the lion's bad enough, the lioness is bad enough, and the wolf is bad, and the bear, but don't be around the tiger. The tigers are actually bigger than the lions if they're fully grown. He started snarling and went after the horses." End quote. That poor man.
Fucking chaos.
It almost seemed like somehow all of Terry's animals were loose. But that didn't make any sense. So a deputy named Jonathan got a call about a loose lion and a bear, so he headed to Sam and Dolly's property since that was who called. He arrived to find Jumanji come to life. Several loose animals were immediately visible when he got there, and before he could get anyone to answer the door, he followed a gray wolf that he saw running down the road, where it approached somebody's home as Jonathan heard orders to shoot on sight over the radio. If you didn't check your content warnings, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
It's rough. He drew his rifle and shot the wolf and then headed back to a location where other officers were dealing with a lion, knowing that he was the only officer on hand who had a rifle with him, which may be needed for the larger animals. But when he got there, there turned out to be an even more pressing problem somehow, which was a 350-pound black bear charging them, and his rifle was snagged on something in his car. All he had was a Glock. Somehow, he got the bear down with a single shot 7 feet away from him. Can you imagine
how
close 7 feet is?
No, I hate it.
For a 350-pound bear and you have a Glock? And I hate it because in stories like this, it's like there's no way not to talk about it like the animal is the villain.
Right.
And it's like, oh my God, he took him down 7 feet away, but the animal's not the villain.
Right.
At all. But at the same time, you know, you don't want to discount the absolute peril these people were in at this moment.
Right.
The next little while was just a nightmare montage of close combat situations between officers and animals, having to shoot animal after animal after animal, approaching from unexpected places with non-ideal weapons as the sun set, with only a 4-foot cattle fence keeping any of them even theoretically confined to Terry's property. Flashing signs went up on the highway that said caution exotic animals and stay in vehicle. Residents were told to stay inside, keep their kids inside, keep their pets inside.
I don't feel like that sign is conveying the message that it should.
No, I don't really think it is, because you might think a peacock or something. Yeah. And there was some concern because a mile away from this, there was a kid's soccer game going on outside. So it's screaming kids.
Yeah.
And a bunch of loose lions. GQ wrote, "All evening it went on, the slaughter. Encounters with animals that would normally have been remembered for a lifetime were forgotten moments later as the next came along." The police would later take a lot of criticism for what they did. There's no scenario where they wouldn't have.
Right.
To be honest. But do you know who Jack Hanna is?
Yeah.
Okay. So Jack Hanna, TV personality, director of the Columbus Zoo, he would later say, "What was he to do at nighttime with tigers and lions, leopards going out there? In the wild, this would be a different situation." And he also said that when an animal is shot with a tranquilizer, quote, "the animal gets very excited, it goes and hides, and then we have this officer in danger of losing their life and other people."
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you give them the tranquilizer, they freak out. It doesn't work for 10 minutes. It looks like it's instant in the movies. It's not in reality. And there was no way to confine them. It's not like you're, you know, tranquilizing an animal in the pen and then it's going to fall down somewhere and you get it where it is. You have a disoriented, angry animal rampaging for 10 minutes until it finally passes out who knows where in the open countryside. So that wasn't the solution that people want it to be. You hear this and you want to say, why didn't you just tranquilize them? But I really don't think it was that simple.
Right.
Now, the one creature no one had laid eyes on in all this was Terry. So the sergeant drove up to his house to do a welfare check at the very least. As he got closer, some things came into focus. The animals' fences and containers had been very intentionally cut and even destroyed so that captured animals could not be returned to them. He ran into an animal caretaker who was trying to suss things out, and together they searched the home without luck. It was filled with garbage, feces, items in terrible shape.
Yeah, because he was hoarding.
And I mean, his mental health was so bad, and he'd just gotten back after a year, 3 weeks ago, and it doesn't sound like things were maintained very well. I am not placing any blame because I don't know what Marion was going through.
Right.
With him and his abuse and his prison sentence. I don't know what her situation was, but at this point, the house is in very, very bad shape. Caretaker and his fiance walked them through the cages and inventoried the animals that they normally fed to help law enforcement get a head count of what was out there. Three leopards had been left in their cages and survived, along with two monkeys in small bird cages, and a grizzly bear is somehow also confined to a bird cage.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't follow the logistics of this. The math ain't mathin', but that's what happened.
Must be like one of those big, like, Audubon cages.
Yeah. So as they left, they found a white tiger eating a dead body. They took it to be Terry, but they couldn't safely approach. So they went back to the other officers and they reported what they'd found. But they all knew they had to head back and make sure that he wasn't alive and able to be helped. So they assembled in the...
They just let the white tiger keep on going, or...
I don't think they felt like they had the manpower to safely take down the white tiger. So they left and regrouped. I mean, I think it was fairly apparent that the person was dead. But, you know, at some point it's like, well, what if he's not? We better go check.
Right.
So they assembled some men in the back of a Chevy Silverado so no one would have to shoot through windows. And they had a SWAT sniper on the team. And at parts, it sounds like you must be thinking that at least some of the men this had to be secretly fun for. And maybe some of them, I don't know, but definitely not all of them. One said, I was sick shooting these animals because they didn't ask to be there. And you know, I'm a cat person.
Oh my goodness.
That broke my heart.
Oh.
Right?
It's so, like, pss, pss, pss.
I know. Oh no. So they approached and they were charged by tigers and they were able to do what had to be done. And approached the body that they had spotted earlier and confirmed that it was beyond saving. Before they could confirm the body's identity, they were pulled away by a situation with multiple lions in a field full of overgrown abandoned cars and RVs that were part of Terry's hoard, and that was dealt with. They got back to the body, and they found the in episode content warning for suicide. They got back to his body and they found a revolver that he'd used to end his life and they found bolt cutters. He had been dragged around the pen, chewed, partially undressed by the animals, but the officers found raw chicken around his body, implying that Terry's intention had been for the animals to eat him.
Right.
They had also removed his genitals entirely.
Oh.
Yeah. So... I have to read you this section from the GQ article directly because the sheer Jurassic Park energy cannot be paraphrased. Quote, 40 miles away at the Columbus Zoo, an event was being held for the International Rhino Foundation. Rhino experts from around the world had gathered, and the zoo was throwing a cocktail party on the grounds of the polar bear exhibit. One of our vets came into the cocktail area, says Tom Stealth, the zoo's chief operating officer, and you could see the panic on her face. She said, we have to go. Terry Thompson's animals are out. End quote. Zoo director had participated in the raid on Terry's property that led to his gun conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Because as horrific as the conditions were for the animals, it was more or less legal. But they knew what was what in there, so they had brought him in with them to do a raid. So Columbus did send their tranquilizer-armed capture and recovery team to Zanesville, but it ultimately just was not safe for them to do much. And as the number of unaccounted for animals dwindled, officers lined up the animals in rows according to their species near Terry's house. His estranged wife, Marion, arrived and cried. I did not find anything saying much of a reaction to her husband's death. But she cried and she begged to be allowed to remove the monkeys from their cages. And they allowed her to, and she took them out and she sang them lullabies and she carried them tenderly to her carriers. And she said they were like her children. The surviving animals were all safely trained, which none of the ones he released were surviving, but the ones who had still been caged on the property, they were all safely tranquilized and transferred to the Columbus Zoo. So law enforcement and Marion agreed together that the best course of action was to bury the dead animals that had piled up in lines in front of the farm right then on the property. And they let Marion choose the spot. And I cannot imagine the delicate social dynamics that had to have unfolded during this process at all.
Right.
Ultimately, Terry's friends believe that
was like a mass grave.
Yes. Yes, it was huge. Ultimately, Terry's friends believe that when he went to prison, he anticipated that Marion would leave him, and he spent his prison term planning the most effective way to hurt her back. That she had loved the animals more than anything, and it was mostly at this point more of a having more just to have more thing for him, a hoarding thing, an arrogance thing, an ego thing, but she genuinely loved them.
Right.
So he went to prison and he thought, she's not gonna hang around and wait for me. And if that's the case, when she gets out, I'm taking all of them out with me as his final act of revenge.
So fucked up.
Yeah. Eventually, that one monkey was all that was left, and it was presumed to have been eaten by a larger animal. Animal welfare workers from all around arrived on the scene to find officers apologizing to them for what they'd had to do. Jack Hanna himself hauled ass to Zanesville fresh from a knee surgery and became sort of a liaison between law enforcement and the public. Officers explained the events in detail to him, and then Jack Hanna gave endless interviews, leveraging the trust and respect that most of the community had for him to make sense of this horrible event. Quote, he emotively articulated his pain at the deaths that had taken place, his unequivocal insistence that the sheriff's department had no other option than to act as they did, served as a powerful antidote to the other obvious narrative, that a thoughtless small-town law enforcement brigade had murdered dozens of noble beasts because they were too dumb and trigger-happy to think of a better alternative. It's like Noah's Ark wrecking, he proclaimed, right here in Zanesville, Ohio, end quote.
I'm curious if Jack Hanna, I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit of a...
He's controversial. Did you know that?
What?
Did you know that he's controversial?
He is?
He is. Apparently, he used to own exotics himself, and the exotics community basically thinks that he's a holier-than-thou, preachier piece of shit, who a little boy lost his arm because of one of Jack Hanna's animals when he was an exotics owner, and he kind of saw the light about this and stopped. And from what I can gather, the exotics community deeply resents him for that because they think that he's looking down on them when he used to do it too, basically.
Right. I don't know. I'm curious if he, for it, like, if he got compensation, because this is like obviously a PR mess, and right. He's rushing there.
I don't know. I never saw anything to that effect, but I don't know.
It sounds like
definitely
a PR move to
me. Definitely, if he got paid, he definitely earned his pay because he did a lot of interviews and he really smoothed this over for the police officer, for the police department, right here in Zanesville, Ohio. And you know, in the Balloon Fest episode, one of their little catchphrases was, all this right here in Cleveland, Ohio. And I feel like we've come full circle.
Yeah.
As a result of what happened in Zanesville, Ohio overhauled their laws on exotic animal ownership, with the new ones being fully enacted by 2014 and grandfathering in existing animals if their owners took certain precautions like insurance and agreeing to be inspected and maintaining certain standards for the sake of the animal's welfare. It has definitely led to a measurable decrease in owned exotic animals in Ohio and better living conditions for the ones remaining. So,
go Ohio!
Go!
What was that noise?
I think I was going to reflexively agree with you, but I was like,
you changed your mind halfway.
Oh, gosh. So, yeah, that Terry's story was rough.
Yeah.
That was a rough one to research.
It's heavy. It's domestic violence, animal abuse, suicide. Yeah. It's,
and you want to place blame somewhere so bad, but like, where do you start? Because you go all the way back.
Terry.
And it ends with Vietnam, probably. Because it sounds like he was normal before that. Right. And I mean, he got drafted to kill people. That's fuck. So, yeah,
That's a super heavy one.
Yeah. Do you want some disaster relief?
Yeah. I need it. I'll go first.
Thank
since
you.
You've been ruining everybody's day.
Everybody's good vibes.
The girls have a birthday party tonight, and they recently built, it's a chain restaurant called Walk-Ons here. They have a lot of, you know, Louisiana cuisine, a lot of shrimp, red beans and rice, all that stuff. But it's on the main, there's not a whole lot where I live, but it's on the main stretch of highway that we travel on. And it's always been real fun. Josie, every time we pass it, is like excited to see it build, like the progress of it, the excavators. Why can't I say that? It's been built for a while, and he's always like, I can't wait to go. I can't wait to go. So we're taking him out to dinner tonight. It's just me, Cody, and the boys while the girls have their little birthday party at their friend's house. And he doesn't know, and I'm so excited just to
That's so sweet.
Surprise him. Yeah.
Oh. I love that.
I'm going to get my red beans tonight.
Red beans.
Post-recording.
God, I can't believe we have an inside joke about my breast pump that is shared with the world. What is life? Okay. So I had a long delay about mine, and I don't actually know why, because I am in the middle of rereading my favorite book. And that for me is like saying my favorite song. Like, how could you? Like, what?
Right.
But I actually do have an all time, above all, not really any significant competition, favorite book in the world.
What is it?
It is Jane Steele by Lindsay Fay. And it is sort of a retelling of Jane Eyre with much gayer and a lot more murder, I believe.
Ooh.
And it is this, I have my book, my copy of this. It is so torn up. It is ridiculous because I've read this book so many times, but I've had a few years of very significant life experiences since I last read it. And this time I have it, and it is shredded to hell. The front cover's half ripped off. A toddler took a marker to the inside in some places. So I have given myself permission to go through it with highlighters and just highlight all my favorite passages. And there's like one on every page almost.
Oh, I love that.
Every sentence is delicious. And I'm so glad that I decided to reread this.
I want to just have time to sit down and read a book. That came off really bitchy and rude. What the fuck? You know that's not what I mean, friend, right?
I do.
Must be fucking nice, Brianne.
I'm like, well, I do stuff, Melanie.
I'm so glad that you have a book that is like falling apart because you have so much time to reread it.
Wow.
That is not how I meant it.
I know.
I
have barely read for like 4 years, like at all.
And I do know this, so apologies for that.
You're fine.
Must be fucking nice.
I love you.
I don't know why. Oh my gosh.
Well, you that do caught have five me off. Children. You do have five children.
I know, but still, that is.
I have one and have barely picked up a book for 4 years. So. Let's times that by 5, and I think I would say the exact same thing.
I'm just going to shit on your disaster relief and then make you pay me compliments. It's a good day to be me.
I can't believe it. I'm happy you're having a great day. It is because you are so constantly right, as Cody knows.
Well, I'm excited that you have finally been able to reread your book, babe.
Are you, though?
I am, I promise. Well, don't let me keep you from it, you know?
I'm going to go enjoy my leisure time now. And get my bonbons out. I have fucking tears in my eyes because you hurt my feelings. Okay.
All right. Go read your fucking book.
No one wants to sit here and listen to us giggle all night.
I'm going to fold some laundry. Let me know how it
work
goes.
Work your fingers to the bone, Melanie. I love you so much.
I love you too. I guess until next time.
Sweet dreams or no dreams.
Sweet dreams or no dreams. Hey, Horrible Ghouls. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you would like to share your personal MarkSafe moment, you can send it to us at MarkSafePodcast@gmail.com. Please give our podcast a rate, review, and subscribe, and tell your buddies about us too. That goes a long way. If you want to further elevate your support, check out our MarkSafe Patreon page, where we have shoutouts, goodies, and some bonus content in the works. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again, and as always, stay safe.